Congratulations, you have found the Lambcast, the official podcast of the Large Association of Movie Blogs, also known as the Lamb. The Lamb is the largest collective of online movie blogs and podcasts with 2,000 members and counting. Every week on the Lambcast, various members of the Lamb community get together to talk about our favorite subject, movies. So bookmark the Lamb and follow us on social media. Be sure to join us each week to hear a lively discussion of films and movie-related talk from our members. Join the flock at largeassmovieblogs.com.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. The Graduate, Bonnie and Clyde, and In the Heat of the Night were nominated for Best Picture, but so were Dr. Doolittle and Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. The Graduate and Bonnie and Clyde were 1 and 2 at the box office, but Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, Valley of the Dolls, and Thoroughly Modern Millie were 2, 5, and 8, respectively. Emily Watson, Paul Giamatti, Philip Seymour Hoffman, and Mark Ruffalo and Jamie Foxx were born, but Vivian Leigh, Claude Rains, and Spencer Tracy died. Gary Busey, Richard Dreyfuss, Faye Dunaway, and Pat Morita all made their film debuts, but it was in The Love-Ins, Valley of the Dolls, Hurry, Sandown, and Thoroughly Modern Millie. It was the year of Bedazzled, Belle de Jour, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, and I Am Curious Yellow, but also the year of The Million Eyes, The Sumeru, Berserk, and Oh Dad, Poor Dad, Mama's Hung You in the Closet, and I'm Feeling So Sad, which wasn't even the longest title of the year. That belongs to Murat Saad. In short, the period was so far like the present period that some of its noisiest authorities insisted on its being received for good or for evil in the superlative degree of comparison only. In other words, it was a year like any other year. Hello and welcome to the Lambcast, the Large Association of Movie Bloggers. I am your host this week. I am Howard Kastner of Pop Art Podcast, Richard Kirkham, who normally leads these discussions, had to be out of town. At least that's his story, and he's sticking to it. This week, we are doing the year 1967 in retrospective. We will be giving a top five movies for that year. This doesn't mean our panelists will be choosing the best. They can choose any category they want, from top five films with left-handed actors, to the most boring films of the year, to the most unfortunate sex scenes with an animal. You know who you are. To the top five foreign films with maybe one in the English language, but I won't say who that last one is, because it was me. And remember, it is a far, far better thing we do than we have ever done. It is a far, far better set of choices than we have ever chosen. Our panelists include, Aaron Neuwirth from Out. If I get any of these wrong, tell me, because I'm often bad at this. Aaron Neuwirth from Out Now with Aaron and Dave, who was last seen giving a long-winded speech about how he has no right to interfere with his daughter's wedding, no matter the race of the man she is marrying.
Out Now with Aaron and Abe, and thank you. Hi.
Next is David Brook of Blueprint Review, last seen being filled with a million bullets after stopping to help someone along a Depression-era back road.
Had it coming to them.
We will maybe be joined by DM Anderson, David Anderson. We haven't contacted him yet. He's of the Free Movies Guide, and he was last seen stopping a wedding and running off with his love on a bus. And finally, we are joined by Todd Liebenau I can never remember the name of your podcast, Todd.
The Forgotten Film Cast.
Oh, that's
some people
right.
Call it Forgotten Films. You know, it gets changed around, whatever people feel like.
Some people just forget.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Now I remember. It's easy to forget.
Yeah, now I remember. He was last seen wearing a sheriff's badge and carrying a black detective's bag to a train.
I did not do a list of my top five films with left-handed actors, but because I am left-handed, I would love to hear that list someday if somebody does it. But.
That would be fun. I'd like to hear the one with the unfortunate sex scenes with animals, but
to each his own.
We will be going round robin. And so now I'm going to give you a choice. Do you want to do Pineapple Kiosk? even though it rarely comes up in these look-back shows, or we can have both panelists talk about the same film they chose. And if the second person has a film they can add to their list, they can then do that. Which way would you rather go?
I have a lot of backups, so I'm good with whatever.
Well, I don't, but I would say, you know, wait for the higher ranking, do the pineapple kiosk. I think that rule works. But
yeah, I'd do that. I mean, I doubt there's anything going to come up, but yeah, I'd say pineapple kiosk, I think, because I haven't prepared anything else.
First, I have two questions. To begin, were any of you born 1967 or before?
No, I was born in 71. So
to that, I say, you and the horse.
82.
Next, I thought we would go around, and I have a reason for this, and say what we thought of 1967 as a year in movies overall. As you were doing your research, what did you think of the year in movies? So we can start with Aaron Neuwirth, put you on the spot out of nowhere, question out of nowhere that you weren't prepared for.
No, I if I'm looking at the year as a whole, based on the research I've done for the movies I chose, my main takeaway is, wow, men, specifically white men, are the worst in so many cases. even Spencer Tracy's like, oh, I guess I am kind of racist. And Robert Redford's like, I don't know about this Jane Fonda. Like, there's just a lot of like people that are making choices that reflect poorly when I look at it now. I have a very specific theme for my list that I'll get to when we talk about the movies. But like the movies, outside of random observations, there's plenty of classics here. I mean, and there's a whole literal new wave of cinema coming into America, along with, you know, overseas as well. So there were a lot of fun options that I could go with as far as trying to like assemble what I wanted to do for today. But because of how narrow my focus is, I got a lot of films of not much of interest happening beyond people moving around to different areas and kind of things occur to them. And I chose less plot specific movies. No, there's a lot of fun to be had here, and a lot of just color and liveliness and things that are here that aren't as manufactured as they are today. And I really appreciated that for sure.
Well, David, what about you?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting year. It's almost a bit of a transitional year. There are changes afoot. And as you say, there's new waves moving around, and it's an interesting one. I've gone with a quite specific theme, kind of, but I've cheated a little bit, but we'll get into that later. But a real solid, interesting year for me.
And what about you, Todd?
Yeah, it's a unique year. It was a little hard to decide which way to go with things. I mean, like Aaron said, there's certainly plenty of classics that could be talked about, you know, movies that, as I was developing as a film fan, people would say, well, you must see this, you must see this. At the same time, you know, when I look over stuff that's there, I mean, there's a lot of interesting things when it comes to foreign cinema. There's interesting things when it comes to, like, you know, genres like the spaghetti westerns, you know, a lot of different unique directions to go there. You know, things that are kind of a holdover from like the classic Hollywood, you know, as like Dave was saying, we're transitioning into, you know, what we would see more of in the 70s. So, yeah, it's a unique time for sure.
The reason why I brought this up, because there's a book by Mark Harris called Pictures at a Revolution, which I highly recommend. It's a history and study of the five films that eventually were nominated for Best Picture for that year. And its thesis is that the Oscars that year were, or in 68, but it was for 67 films, were a reflection and even symbolic of the war between old Hollywood and new Hollywood. And even though the final selection for Best Picture was a compromise between the two, it showed that the new Hollywood won, at least for a few decades. And then an old type of Hollywood comes back, but that's a discussion for another time. So he saw 1967 as a real, as you say, symbolic of the transition between the new Hollywoods. So this may be one of the most important years I'm not saying best or worst, but just important years in Hollywood history. So let's go on with our choices. And of course, as you start, tell us why you chose that. And I mean, what your theme is for your list, and then talk about the theme and shows. So we'll go back in the same order. Aaron, take it away.
Okay. Well, last time I was here for, 78, I went with films I had never seen before. And I didn't want to be boring and do that same theme again. That'd be ridiculous. At the same time, I didn't want to also be boring and choose all these random classics like Bonnie and Clyde and shit you've talked about plenty. So I decided instead to go entirely international with my list. I could say specifically New Wave, but I mean, there's some films that are arguable here, depending on what I'm able to talk about. But I mainly have a lot of New Wave films. I tried not to lean too French, but God damn it, there's so many French movies. But instead of starting with French, I'll start with Japan. I'll start with a film called Branded to Kill. During the pandemic, I discovered Seijin Suzuki through a film called Tokyo Drifter, a film that I am not sure how I got this far into my life without having known that movie, because it was so entirely up my alley in terms of everything it was doing, let alone immediately understanding all the things it was referencing. And so I'm like, what else has this man done? Because I need to see all of these movies. So I watched Branded to Kill also very quickly after seeing Tokyo Drifter. And this movie also rules. I am a huge fan of a movie like this. I'm also a huge fan of directors that are told, don't do this, and then they do this, and then the studio's like, you're fired. And that's what happened with this movie. It's like, Seijin Suzuki's like, he's so experimental and absurdist with his style. And not unlike, I don't know, Yoshimitsu Amano, who made Godzilla vs. Ghidorah, who also got fired. It's like, no, I'm going to do the thing I want to do. And he does. He makes this crazy hitman movie where this guy who's like the number three assassin is put on a job. Things go kind of sideways. And now the number one assassin's eventually going to try to kill him. And that's like the basic plotting. But so much of this is dependent on like the weird of it all. The main character, it's Goro. Number three, he has a fetish for cooked rice, like that turns him on. The kind of detail you expect from a movie like this. He has a wife who's just weirdly sexual all the time with him. Meanwhile, he has like another woman that's hired him, and she's also like this psychosexual type character. There's a lot of cool action in this movie. And when I say cool action, I mean, there's a lot of guy holds gun, shoots things. None of it seems real. Like there's reloading only when necessary. The action is not like choreographed, like John Wick style. It's just more of like, yeah, now an action scene, but there's like cool setups for it. Like there's a sequence where number one is like after number three, or like one of the assassins is after number three. And he's on like a narrow bridgeway, and he only has his car. So he gets under his car, and there's like a rope with a hook on it. So he hooks the rope up to the car and then pulls the other side of the rope. So it like slowly wheels up the car as like he crawls under it to get closer and closer. There's just like inventive stuff like that. It's filmed in lush black and white. I got the new 4K from Criterion recently, and it looks gorgeous. There's a variety of themes in here. There's a lot of like dead butterfly imagery that's going on. That's also like, okay, that's a choice. It has this, I don't want to say bizarro conclusion, because I've seen other films from this year, but it certainly has a really auspicious conclusion as far as, hey, here's a very symbolic place where we can end this whole thing, and and it'll take you in multiple directions. Like seeing this movie after the fact that I've seen so many other movies, there's a very, I know where Ghost Dog got a very big inspiration from, for sure. Jim Jarmusch's film. You can easily see John Woo, Park Chan-wook, Wong Kar-wai, even. You can see a lot of inspirations there. The one that I found most interesting that I looked up is that Lupin the Third was heavily inspired by this movie, which is like, that's awesome. I love that. So yeah, no, I'm a huge fan of Branded to Kill. I was really happy to watch it again in preparation for this. Yeah, just a real fun Japanese new wave movie.
Has anybody else seen the film?
Yes, I love this film. I haven't seen this one for quite a while. But I've seen Tokyo Drifter more often. I love that, I do have very fond memories of Brandon's Kill. Have you seen Youth of the Beast yet? That's very good. It's not as wild as those films. It was made before he kind of really went quite as out there. But it's kind of somewhere in between. It's kind of a really solid gangster movie, but with these cool stylistic kind of touches. I'm definitely with you on this choice. Absolutely.
Great.
I love the actor as well. Oh, sorry, I was gonna say Joe Shishido. He's in loads of great Japanese movies. He's always memorable with his chipmunk cheeks.
I've seen it too. It's very, very weird. So it's a lot of fun. It did get him blacklisted for 10 years because the studio fired him. He sued the studio one, but he didn't work for 10 years. I did see his earlier films are more traditional. They're very film noir. Take Aim at the Police Van. I saw, though I have to be honest, by the time it was over, I wasn't quite sure why anybody was taking aim at the police van. And I could be wrong, but I thought he did one that was basically a Japanese version of Stagecoach. But takes place on a bus. And if I'm right, it's very good. I recommend it.
I know there's a sequel to this film also, Pistola Opera, which I haven't seen, but apparently has good reviews. So now I'm like,
oh, yeah, yeah.
So and it was made like recently. It was made like in 2000s. I'm like, all right, he's up there.
Okay, yeah, he had a bit of a resurgence in more recent years. I'm sorry.
Oops. Need to go back. David Brook, what is your theme?
Okay, well, I went with the clear because my theme is quite often or just random stuff from a collection that I've not watched. But this time, I mean, these are collection films from a collection that I've not watched. But I picked a more specific theme until the end, and then I saw something that was awesome and I wanted to talk about it, so I squeezed it in there. But for the most part, for 4 out of 5 of these films, the first 4, I am going to go with spaghetti westerns because looking through, I kind of made a big list of what I own that is from 67, and there were so many spaghetti westerns in there. And this was kind of a year when the genre was kind of full flow. It was about to kind of die off in the next couple of years, but it was a full flow now, and there's loads of classic spaghetti westerns out there, so I thought I would stick with that. And I've kind of mainly gone with ones I've gone with ones I've not seen before, so it's quite new to me. So I'm going to start the first one, the kind of least impressive one, but it's still decent, and that's a film called $10,000 Blood Money, or I think it's also known as $10,000 for a Massacre, I think, something like that. It's technically a Django film, although that might depend on the translation.
There's a lot of Django films out
there. But there's no Franco Nero. This is Gianni Garco. Apologies for the pronunciation. And yeah, he's in town and he's hired by like a rich Mexican businessman to rescue his daughter, who gets kidnapped by this notorious Mexican bandit who's played by Claudio Camasso. But initially, Django's not interested. He's been a bit of a dick around about it, really. He's not been offered enough money. The money he's been offered to do this job isn't enough, so he's a bit like, nah, I'm good. And he actually ends up the bandit ends up offering him more money to help him to do a bank job. So Django kind of starts helping out this bandit and getting involved with his crew. So they have quite an uneasy relationship because you still feel like Django might want to go and claim that money, especially when the rich landowner starts hiking up the price. So there's a nice bit of a kind of a playoff between those. It's just a good, solid spaghetti western. You've got a bit of humor in there. You've got like Django shoots like a smiley face into a flask as a warning, all this kind of stuff. You've got, as usual, it looks really nice. Great use of the wide frame, some nice camera moves. There's a few slightly unusual touches for Spaghetti Western. Not that many, but like the opening shot is on a beach, which isn't what you'd normally think of. You usually think of them as the driest, sweatiest films ever, and it opens on a beach. It's quite unusual. But yeah, it's decent. As I say, I quite liked. There's a few twists and turns to keep you kind of hooked to the story, even if some of it is fairly generic. And it's just, yeah, good, solid, fun time. So recommended, if not one of the better examples of the genre. Has anyone else seen it?
No, I'm not familiar with it. So it sounds like something definitely to check out, because spaghetti westerns are fun. Often they're fun because they're bad, and often they're fun because they're good. It's like film noir. You don't necessarily watch them because they're great movies. You watch them because you like that genre.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I got this from a box set. It's one I'd not heard of, really, but Arrow released a box set full of them. They've done a few of these now. I think they've done three.
Okay.
One of these box sets. This is the second set, the Blood Money set, and it's in there. And my next film will be from that set, too. So we'll get to that later.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Todd, take it away.
Oh, well, as I was looking through 1967, a bunch of the films that jumped out at me where I was like, I kind of want to talk about that film, struck me as, you know, kind of being the type of thing that you might see at the drive-in theater. So I decided to go with five drive-in movies. And these kind of go across a bunch of different genres. And the one that I'm going to start with is actually the feature directing debut of a filmmaker maybe you've heard of named William Friedkin. This is the film Good Times, which stars Sonny and Cher. This is the Sonny and Cher movie where they play themselves. And essentially the idea is that, you know, it's trying to do A Hard Day's Night with Sonny and Cher type of thing. But, you know, here the idea is that there's a guy, a producer, that wants to make a Sonny and Cher movie. He's played by George Sanders. And so most of the film is them kind of imagining themselves in different types of movies as they try to decide what kind of movie they're going to make. So we see them in like a Western, and we see them in like a Tarzan film and a detective film, things like that. It's corny. These are basically skits and they're corny. But the two leads are just so darn likable. And in a lot of ways, it's an interesting film to watch in terms of thinking about where Sonny and Cher were going to go in the 70s, you know, with the variety show success that they would have. I mean, that's something that was a big deal, so much so that they kept doing it even after they broke up as a couple. It was a formula that worked for them. And so here we kind of see the genesis of that. Part of the real charm of the film is that they have a lot of fun at their own expense. They're not afraid to look silly in this, which is something that works for them. And in fact, one of the things that's kind of funny about the movie is that, and this isn't really a spoiler, I guess, but at the very end of the movie, they decide they're not going to make a movie after all because they don't want to look silly. But the whole film has been about making them look silly. So I kind of found that fun. But also, I mean, just in terms of this being William Friedkin's first movie, I mean, probably one of the most unusual things in his career. But I mean, he does a solid job with it. You know, he shows a flair for comedy. It's shot in a visually interesting way. I mean, it's really unlike anything he ever did. You know, everybody's got to start somewhere. And I think this is a really interesting way to begin, considering where his career would go. So, yes, it's a very goofy film, but I think it's very charming.
So you didn't watch this and think this man will remake Wages of Fear at some point?
No. There's absolutely no indication of things like Sorcerer or The Exorcist or the French Connection. None of that comes through in this movie, you know?
The whole people, George Sanders.
Well,
I guess it means it's my turn.
What you got for us, Howard? What you got for us, Howard?
Yes, but I usually do what I usually do. I just choose my favorite or what I think are the best films of that year. So I will begin with Bedazzled, directed by Stanley Donen, written by Peter Cook, and it stars Peter Cook and Dudley Moore. It's a retelling of the Faust legend set in, of course, the swinging 60s in London. A young man works at a Wimpy Burgers and he wants to ask his co-worker out, but is too scared to. So the devil offers him 7 wishes in return for a soul, but every wish backfires on the young man, often spectacularly. Aesthetically, it's kind of dated. It looks very 60s, very sort of shaky camera documentary-like look. But I think it still holds up. I think it's hysterically funny. You know, and remember, the secret word is Julie Andrews. So.
I actually just watched this fairly recently. I've seen the remake many times.
Many times.
It's one of those films that popped up on cable like all the time. It's like, oh, look, there's Brendan Fraser singing about the seals again or whatever that scene. I don't remember. But anyway, this film, I agree. I think it's pretty funny, though I would say it loses some steam in the third act for me. But I thought the first two acts of the film are quite funny.
With that, whoops, we are back to Aaron. What you got for us?
All right. And by the way, Stanley Donen, super busy in the 60s. I was just looking at his, because I looked, I was like, oh, yeah, The Dazzle came out that year. But it's like, geez, Donen just didn't stop working. Like, he was just constantly at it. My next film.
I was going to say, he was very big and very important in making musicals in the 1950s. And then that sort of died out. So, yeah, he moved into other things and made a lot of films. Yeah.
It just didn't hold him back. He's like, I guess I'll go with the musical thing, but I'm still going to, like, just keep making everything. Anyway. My next film is a film that I had not seen until recently. I've been wanting to see it. I wanted to see it specifically projected in 70mm, which I almost was able to at the Egyptian Theater over in Los Angeles, but I just couldn't make the time. But it is Playtime. Jacques Tati's...
Sorry. Hmm? Pineapple Kiosk.
Oh, you're stop me right there.
Yeah. We actually had a Pineapple Kiosk here. Wow. So we'll talk about it later when I bring it up.
All right, then I'll go for another French film, The Young Girls of Rochefort.
Okay.
Oh, nice.
Good, yeah. Another Jacques, Jacques Demy. I also had not seen this film until recently. I'd seen The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, which I really, really like. And now, why I didn't get to this sooner, I don't know. A lot of things come up, but it's like I'm so into what Demi's doing as far as the way French musicals sound to me is just honestly just more intriguing than most musicals. I just like the way it sounds, regardless of them reading the subtitles or just listening to how it all plays out. I like the way, at least in these two films, he's incorporating music in such a frequent pace, where it's obviously there are like set pieces or what have you. But the way music just informs so much of the body of the film, I find to be just impressive and really enhances the world in the right kind of way. As far as like the movies, I mean, it's gorgeous. It has just such a great use of color, as I find most European films from before 1972. There's just such the way color looks to me in these movies is just always like intriguing and fantastic. You have a number of people here. You have Catherine Deneuve. You have Georges Chakiris, playing an actual white man and not being put in brown makeup. You have Gene Kelly just showing up. He's like, why not? And that was a surprise to me. The plot is more like expand. Yeah.
You have also Francois Dauriac, who is Catherine Deneuve's sister.
Yes, you have the actual sisters playing sisters in this movie.
Yeah, and she died very young.
The actual plot is like more expansive compared to Cherbourg, which is, it's focused on two people. This one is like, here's multiple plot threads and what have you. I find the plot's good. Like, there's nothing wrong with like the story and what it's doing, but it's just more of the style and the look of the whole thing. And just this constant, like 5 minutes in, I'm like, I'm going to like all of this because it just has a certain tone to it. That's just really engaging, keeps me just my eye on the screen and just watching all the different dance numbers and songs, what have you, with the I mean, I guess it's a musical. Most of them are ADR anyway, but like, there's just the way the way you hear it, the way the sound plays in, the way there's scenes of characters going through a whole dance number or what have you and walking around, and then they hop into a car and drive off and they're still singing. Like, there's just stuff like that that just feels really interesting to me as far as how to make a musical number work without feeling so pronounced in the way that you see them in a lot of Hollywood musicals. It just, I really enjoyed this movie a lot.
No, it's a really sweet, it's a really fun film.
It was my first Jacques Demy film, and I love it. It's still my favorite. It's a wonderful film. It looks incredible. I do enjoy the songs. I went through the whole box set that Criterion did, and after that I went and bought there's a really nice box set of CD box set of the music from his films that what's his name, the guy who did this, the music for that. Michelle
Michelle Legrand. He didn't do that, did
yes
he?
That
yes. Michelle Legrand. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, that's the one. There's a really nice set with all the music that he did with Legrand in there, and it's another great choice.
I think it also should be noted that he is married, or was married, because both have died. He died relatively young of complications related to AIDS, but his wife is Agnes Varda, who's one of the great French film directors. Todd's turn.
Is it me next, I think, actually?
Yeah.
Oh, who did I miss?
Me, David.
David Brooke?
Yes.
Oh, sorry. That was you.
Oh, no, I was just butting in at the end of the...
Okay, take it away, David.
Okay, yeah, so going back to Spaghetti Western. So as I say, this next film is another one from the kind of Arrow set of kind of pretty random Spaghetti Westerns that I hadn't previously heard of, but because I'm a fan of the genre, I was like, I'm picking that up anyway. But the next one is interesting because it's not a sequel to $10,000 Blood Money, but it's got the same two lead actors and kind of quite some vaguely similar themes. So it's kind of a weird kind of semi-sequel to it. And that's a film called Vengeance Is Mine, otherwise known as $100,000 for a Killing. So your budget's gone up in this one. this is another real solid Western. So in this one, again, we've got Gianni Garco is our kind of protagonist. He plays a guy called Johnny Forrest. And he's just come out of jail. He's been there for 10 years. And his mother gives him a final wish in her dying moments that she wants him to find his half brother, Clint. She wants to bring him to justice because he's gone off the rails. He's become a kind of a bandit and stuff. And he's a bad guy. And but she pleads with him not to necessarily kill him, says only shoot back if he shoots at you. But Johnny, the twist in this is that Clint is the one who put Johnny in jail for 10 years. So he's not happy with him. But anyway, they meet up, and similarly to the last film, they end up having to kind of work together. Johnny catches Clint quite early on, and he kind of keeps him prisoner in the idea is to take him to justice, put him in prison. But along the way, they're chased by Clint's these guys that Clint has double crossed and stolen the titular kind of $100,000. And so Johnny gets embroiled with that, and the two have to kind of work together to escape the other bad guys. And it kind of goes on from there. So yeah, again, it's got a nice kind of, the central relationship is interesting, which keeps you watching, which keeps the film from getting tedious. And it's a good solid film. It's also got some good set pieces. The opening scene's actually got a bit of a horror vibe going on it. And these kind of bandits come in, and Johnny's set these coffins up for them and all this kind of stuff, and they're in this spooky abandoned house in the middle of the night. So it's got some nice little twists and turns to it. It's not quite your standard Spaghetti Western, even though there's a lot of those kind of bits and pieces in there. So yeah, it gets really pretty bleak and tragic in the kind of final act, which I didn't see coming, and So it's got a more emotional heft than the last film. So it's definitely of the two, the stronger. But yeah, so I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it quite a lot.
According to Wikipedia, this was the director's first film.
Possibly. He's not a director I know very well. Yeah, Giovanni Fargo? I don't know how to pronounce it.
It says, yeah, represents the directorial debut of Giovanni Fargo, also known as Sidney Lean for some reason.
it was a habit, especially the Westerns. I think they quite often change the names of the director and sometimes the stars to make it look as though it's an American Western. Even though
Johnny Garko is also Gary Hudson, is like his American name. So.
Yeah. Supposedly, he chose that himself because he wanted a bit of Gary Cooper and a bit of... what's his name? My brain. Oh, who's the Hudson? Anyway.
Hudson is there.
No, okay.
Rock Hudson.
Yeah, I think that was the one. Yeah, and he was trying to get a bit of both in there.
Great. Well, Todd, your turn.
Okay, so my next one that you might have seen at the drive-in, I went for a kids movie this time, a stop-motion animated film from Rankin-Bass, Mad Monster Party, which is very much in the style of their Christmas specials that they're known for, you know, like Santa Claus is Coming to Town, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, that type of thing. But this is a Halloween-themed theatrical film, and... basically using kind of the classic monster characters, Dracula, the werewolf, Frankenstein's monster, the mummy, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, that type of thing. And just doing a kind of fun kids romp with them. And, in a lot of ways, it's just kind of a nice salute to those classic movie monsters. Though, you do have, instead of the Bride of Frankenstein, because they didn't want to get sued by Universal, they have the Monster's Mate, which is voiced by Phyllis Diller, which I could do without Phyllis Diller, but she gets old quick. But otherwise, it's a lot of fun. Very much aimed at kids, written by folks that were involved in Mad Magazine. And also they contributed to kind of the character design of things. So it's got some unique kind of character designs to these puppets that they use for the stop motion. It is a little bit jerky when it comes to the animation. I mean, the Rankin-Bass stuff, doesn't look the same as like the Nightmare Before Christmas. It doesn't flow with, the kind of graceful movements that they have in those films. It was somewhat crude. But it gets the job done. You've got some fun voices going on. Boris Karloff shows up because Boris Karloff would always show up. Most of the voices being done by Alan Swift, and they're really, really good. There's some fun musical numbers to it, which also kind of nod to what was popular at the time in 1967. There's this band of mop-topped Beatles-inspired skeletons who... Nice. Have a band called Little Tibia and the Fibias, which just kind of love that. Kind of similar theme to my first pick there. It's not a great movie, but it's kind of goofy fun. And, certainly one that's a lot of fun to watch around Halloween time and that the whole family can enjoy.
What I find interesting is actually the title isn't Mad Monster Party. It's Mad Monster Party?
Yeah, there's a question mark on the end.
There's a question mark at the end.
I kind of feel like I saw this when I was a kid. It's how the name sounds familiar, but I can't remember. It was a long time ago.
I've seen this poster, and I'm always like, I need to watch this, and I never got into it. It's streaming? Is it, available?
I'm not sure if it is. I know for a long time, it was kind of hard to get a hold of, and I remember... It showed up back when Netflix first started doing streaming. It showed up on there, back when Netflix did movies that were old on there.
You can rent it, but it's not streaming free right now.
Yeah, right now it's not on any streaming services, it looks like.
My next one is a French film, Les Samouraïs.
Good pick.
Written and directed by Jean-Pierre Melville and starring Alain Delon. Melville was one of the big neo or French film noir, French noir directors of the time. This is one of his best movie is not a noir, it's Army of Shadows, which is a World War II story, but this is perhaps his second best noir after Bob Le Flambeur, or Bob the Gambler. And it follows two characters, a hitman played by Alain Delon, who is trying to find out who hired him for a job and then tried to have him killed, and a Parisian commissaire trying to catch him. One of the funniest set pieces for me, I've seen this three or four times, is whenever you're in the police offices, the commissaire just goes from office to office and office and office around in a circle. I'm going, well, that's, I get the symbolism. He's just going around in circles trying to catch this guy. But it's a very interesting piece of architecture. I find it riveting. It's incredible to look at. It's very influential. I mean, you can see the influence in movies as recently as The Killer.
It's a captivating movie. I remember we did it on as a movie of the month a few years ago, and it was one of those cases where just everybody was just kind of just awestruck by the film. So
this was my number one pick when I chose my theme, and I'm also like, this will probably come up, so I didn't want to like actually talk about it for my main thing. There's no one cooler than Alain Delon in this year, let alone probably this decade. And this is a year that literally has a character who's named Cool Hand Luke. So I mean, Alain Delon is so cool in this movie. Just watching him, I literally have it playing on mute in the background right now as recording this podcast. Like I love Le Summer. It is, outside of like one or two other movies, it's my favorite film of this year. I think it's just wonderfully assembled. The atmosphere is terrific. It's probably my favorite Melville film, but yeah, Army of Shadows and one or two others are certainly vying for supremacy as well. But no, I think this movie is absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, agreed. It's incredible.
It was a difficult year for me to determine the five in order. And as you mentioned, Le Summer is your favorite. And yeah, I mean, it was a hard decision for me to where to place it. I think I interrupted somebody. Did I interrupt you, David?
No, I was just agreeing that it's an amazing film. That's all.
That was me. So we're back to Aaron, right? If I got this right,
yep,
am I losing it?
You're good. No, you lost it years ago. You're still fine, though.
Oh, God, yes. Aaron, your turn.
My next film, I'm sticking with France. I'm going with Jean-Luc Godard's Weekend, a postmodern black comedy, I think is like the way that like critics would describe it at the time. This is surreal, does not begin to explain like how this movie works. Have you guys seen Weekend before I just launch into this thing?
Oh, yes.
Howard has.
I have a story about it, actually, about seeing it.
All right, well, we'll get to that. But yeah, this movie... I wasn't prepared for like how, and I've seen Godard films, like I know he can make choices, but I wasn't prepared for like how just bonkers this movie was going to be. And I'm sure he'd love me saying your movie was bonkers, but this film, it focuses on like a couple. They're like a bourgeoisie kind of couple. They're on a drive to the wife's parents' house because like her father's dying, and they feel like they can get the inheritance, and if that means murdering like the mom, so be it. But at this, and also like both of them are having affairs with others, and so they're also thinking, I can kill my spouse and then I get the inheritance plus the lover that I've taken. Like, it's a whole thing. And that's saying the plot is like, yeah, okay, there's a plot, I guess. The movie itself is like, so much imagery here is presented in a way where it throws you off of your rhythm. Like, just when you think you have an understanding, it just sends you further down the rabbit hole. And I say that very literally because Alice in Wonderland is a key reference point in this movie, a movie that's set in 1967 France, that has so much fantastical stuff in it. You encounter literal like French revolutionaries along the way, just hanging out in the grass or whatever, just talking stuff. There's a lot of car crash imagery in here. a thing that you might not have expected me to say as my next sentence, but that's true. To the point where it's very gruesome. You'll have them just like stuck in traffic or like walking because their car eventually gets trashed, and you'll just like encounter these fiery car crashes and bodies strewn all over the place. There's a lot more gunfights than you may expect for this movie. there's a lot of, because of the 60s, there's a lot of like title card placements that happen to break up the editing and like change up the momentum of the film. There are so many choices being made here, where the first half is largely farce, despite having kind of a sense of macabre to it. And then the second half becomes this like revolutionary screed where you have them encountering like these hippie characters and things happen from there that I won't detail, just because I don't want to give too much away that's going on in this movie. But it is a wild film that I was not expecting, like how far it would go in kind of delving into the varying themes that it had about, I don't know, humanity and what have you. Knowing like other like Godard films, like was it like Breathless or what's the one that I'm thinking of that just got released again? The clown makeup. What am I thinking of?
Pierre LeFou. Oh,
yeah. Pierre LeFou. Thank you. Thank Jesus. I'm trying to think. Like those ones, they felt less. They weren't throwing me off as much compared to this one, where it's like every 10 steps, I'm like, oh, okay, I think I got her handle on this. Nope, never mind. It's going somewhere completely different. So no, I enjoyed this movie. I think it's quite interesting for sure, but it certainly caught me off guard as far as how avant-garde it would actually be.
Well, yeah, he was a postmodernist before postmodernism really became the thing. I first saw it in college, and I was already a Godard fan, but I have to be honest, even though I was a big Godard fan, I saw Weekend, and I didn't get it. I didn't understand what the point was. I didn't this, you know, whatever. Then I moved to Los Angeles. And after a few years living in Los Angeles, I thought, well, I'll give it another try. And Weekend is part of the satire of Weekend is that every weekend, the bourgeois, the Parisian bourgeois, go to the country. And they're maniacs in how they drive. Mm-hmm. So I've lived in Los Angeles for 3 or 4 years, and I go, oh my God, I get it, because the drivers in Los Angeles are maniacs, and they're just as bad as the people in this movie. And finally, I got the joke. I understood what the joke was. And it's really, that first half is really very, very funny. If you've ever lived in some place like Los Angeles, where the drivers are just, you know, they need to be certified. And then it becomes very weird in the second half. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anybody else seen it?
No, I must admit, I'm not a big Godard fan, but this is one that has always intrigued me. It sounds like I should give it a try. It sounds wild enough to kind of
to go for. It's got that going for it.
Well, it has that road rage scene at the opening. That's very funny.
Yeah, there's a good amount of humor in there that I was quite appreciating for sure.
Yeah, and Godard eventually became an almost full-blown comedian, a comic director. You know, some of the early ones like Breathless and the one about the three friends who break into a house, Band of Outlaws, are much more serious. And then he just suddenly did like Alphaville and this one and Pierre LeFou, and you're right, he's just lost it. Thank God he's lost it, but he's just lost it. Are we back to Todd?
Missed me again.
Did I miss David again? Oh my God. Oh, I'm so sorry. David, take it away.
Okay. So for my next Spaghetti Western, well, I say Spaghetti Western, but actually there's an interview on the disc that I watched, and the director who was of this next film is called Damio Damiani. And the film is A Bullet for the General. So this is a better known spaghetti Western than the previous two. But he in an interview, he claims it isn't a Western at all. I mean, because it's actually set in the Mexican Revolution. It's set in Mexico. It's not the American West at all. So which is a fair point, but it's still widely considered by everyone else as a spaghetti Western. So I'm going to go with that. But yeah, it's about a kind of mysterious American called Bill, played by Lou Castell. And he travels down to Mexico, and he ends up on the train that he's on. The train that he's on is hijacked by a bunch of Mexican revolutionaries led by El Chuncho Munoz, according to the IMDb, but Chuncho, I guess, is what they normally call him. And he's played by Gian Maria Volonté. So strong cast on this one. And one of his fellow kind of gang members is played by Klaus Kinski as well, which is cool. but anyway, so and Lucas Stelt, or Bill, he infiltrates this gang. He fakes helping them to get this train. Well, he does help them get the train, really. And he befriends Chuncho and infiltrates the gang. And you slowly start to realize, it never really spells it out until right towards the end, but you kind of get the idea that he has a mission of his own, which the title kind of gives away. But anyway, and it goes on.
Do you want to give a hug to the general?
Again, similar to the other two films, the film really kind of plays on this relationship between these two characters. Alex Cox even kind of calls it a love story between them, because they become very close. Chuncho really respects Bill, but he's a bit blinded by what Bill is actually trying to do. So that's an interesting aspect. But one of the things that this really does that's beyond kind of a lot of the spaghetti westerns I've mentioned already is much more political. It's a very political film, and you can tell sort of based in the revolution. The final line in the film is basically a call to revolution within the film. So it's got a lot more kind of depth to it. And it's not as kind of overtly stylish as some kind of spaghetti westerns, but it still looks nice. It's got very good production design. It's just very elegantly directed. It does things more subtly than you might think in this kind of film. As I say, it doesn't necessarily spell out what Bill is doing. It is done through how things play out, through how things are shown. And it's just a really, 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 really well put together film. To be honest, after watching it, like, this is the first time I'd seen it, and I had heard good things about it, but I'm totally there. This is easily one of the it is top tier spaghetti western, so I definitely recommend this one. As I say, political, but still full of great set pieces, great performances, and very compelling story. So highly recommended if you've not seen it already.
Okay. I like the fact that this Spanish title is Quien Sabe, which means who knows.
So, more subtle than the American one.
Yeah.
And the director of Amityville 2, The Possession.
Really?
the better Amityville film.
Correct.
Yeah, he has the... Yeah, Damiani, I can't pronounce my language is terrible. He's done some fantastic Italian films as well, actually. I saw a box set of his some of his crime films made in the late 60s and early 70s. They're excellent too. He's definitely one to kind of dig out and look into his work if you've not seen them before.
Great. Well, I think I have it right now. Is it Todd?
Yep, it's me.
Okay, I got it right.
My next pick is The Trip from director Roger Corman.
That's a fun one.
Written by Jack Nicholson. Basically Corman's attempt to cash in on the LSD craze. Basically, you've got Peter Fonda playing a guy who's struggling through his divorce. He has a buddy played by Bruce Dern who takes him off to
guys that have never taken drugs.
Exactly. Well, just wait. They take some off to meet up with a bunch of hippies, including Dennis Hopper, and then Fonda ends up having his first experience with LSD. It's a slim story. I mean, really, the story just kind of is there to give Corman a chance to string together some wild visuals, and quite frankly, that was enough for me. I think he does a really great job with it, and you know, it's kind of interesting the way the film goes between some kind of playful situations that are kind of light and cheery, and then the trip kind of goes bad and things get kind of dark and sinister. You know, so you get plenty of kind of, you know, that typical 60s psychedelic imagery, the whole kind of lava lamp look, that type of thing. Got lots of music from Electric Flag, and I think Corman does a great job of kind of bringing the visuals together with the music in a really interesting way. Good performances all around. Fonda's really solid. I think I like him better in this than even in like Easy Rider. Hopper, of course, is Hopper. Yeah, so he's a lot of fun. But I mean, basically, I guess Corman, the legend has it that he researched this by taking LSD himself, and, you know, not a life choice that I would endorse. But I think when it comes to the films that I've seen that Roger Corman directed, this is one of the best. I mean, Corman's got a long and unique career, and there's some films in his filmography that he directed that are really good, and there are some that are, you know, just churn it out quickly and make a few bucks. This one is really good.
I did like movies with the trip in the title, so I will check this out for sure when I get a chance.
Yeah, it's not a great film, but it's a very entertaining film. It's kind of an important film for the time because it's about the counterculture and about someone who takes LSD and doesn't get punished for it. It was written by Jack Nicholson, and there was a documentary on Roger Corman, and they were talking to Jack Nicholson, and Nicholson started crying because he said, nobody wanted me. Nobody would use me. And then Roger Corman would let him do just about anything he wanted to do. And because of that, now Jack Nicholson is a huge, big star. And he wrote this one, and he directed some others, produced others. And this was a major stepping stone
for him. Yeah, and this is coming the year before, too. I mean, Nicholson has two films that are kind of, I mean, really trippy when it comes to, you know, their themes and visuals and such that he wrote. You know, this comes 67, and then 68, he writes Head for the Monkees, which is also a crazy film to take a look at.
Well, doesn't he do The Shooting this year as well?
When is The Shooting? I don't remember.
Which is a really, it's 1966.
Yeah. Year before. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's a really good Western. It's a low budget Western that, you know, that's very clever. Oh, I think it's me, is it?
Yep.
Yes, it is.
Yes. So I am going to go. Sorry, I have to go all the way down here. Nothing that's too surprising, but it is one of the most important films of the 1960s and the history of film in America, and that is Bonnie and Clyde, which I, again, saw in the last couple of years because we covered it for my podcast Pop Art. It's directed by Arthur Penn, and it stars Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway, with a screenplay by David Newman and Robert Benton, and in it, Bonnie Parker's a board waitress, falls in love with an ex-con, Clyde Barrow, and they start a violent crime spree through the country, Depression era Oklahoma. It actually only lasts a couple of weeks. It seems long that it lasts over longer, but they were only outlaws for like a couple of weeks before they were stopped and killed. And it is a romanticized view of the pair. They change some things from history to make them more likable. But it's very entertaining. It's very well done. It is one of the most influential films of the 60s when it comes to how violence and how anti-heroes become big after this. And it helped bring down the code. movies like this just, you know, the code couldn't handle them. And they were very popular. It's a huge hit.
I mean, I love Bonnie and Clyde. It's a fantastic movie. There, and we did a whole commentary track for it. It was fascinating to just talk about for, you know, an extended period of time. I love the choices it makes to not necessarily subvert things, but certainly add a different, an interesting dimension, like making Warren Beatty, making Clyde impotent. That's just, for a movie like that, that could have a lot more freewheeling sexuality going on. That's a choice that reflects like the fact that Clyde was perhaps gay or what had, like, they just kind of struck down the middle. It's like, what if he's impotent? We'll see where that does, takes us. The brief scene with Gene Wilder and the
the woman
he's with, that's just wonderful. Like, especially like I'd seen this movie after I just known Gene Wilder for being Gene Wilder. And again, I get that this is the same year as like The Producers, but watching him just pop up in this, I'm like, Gene Wilder's in this movie, and it's just like such a like weird joy to see him. Like, he's not playing a comedy character, but he's certainly like, you can look at his reactions and see him as comedic, but it's also like, it's a very serious segment of the film because you have this couple going from, I guess we're all on for this ride, to we are horrified by this. Get us out of here, please. And it's just a change in mood. And then Gene Hackman's in this, which doesn't get enough credit. Yeah. Either. He's so good. Yeah. Was he nominated for this? I forget. Was he?
Yes, there were 5 acting nominations.
Yeah, there's like a ton, right? So I'm like, yeah.
Estelle Parsons won.
Yeah, exactly. She's the one. and he's so good also. The whole movie rocks. Bonnie and Clyde is just a great film.
The interesting thing about the impotence is that in the original screenplay, he is gay or bisexual. Uh-huh. And Michael J. Pollard, and I think the story makes more sense if you know that, because the pickup of Michael J. Pollard doesn't quite convince. But what the basic idea is that he and Bonnie would pick up blonde himbos. And have 3-ways with him, but 2 things happen. First, I think I can't remember who it was, whether it was the director or was Warren Beatty, goes to the writers and said, you know, the American public will have no problem finding hero in this murderer and bank robbery. They'll never forgive him for being gay.
That sounds like
crazy. Well, but he was perhaps right. Because this was the 60s and in America. And if you did try to make him, it's just, you know, that's the way the time was. And as I said, the picking up for Michael J. Pollard part makes more sense if he's part of they're picking up for sex. But as Vito Russo said in Out of the Closet, once you cast Michael J. Pollard in that part, well, there's no way, you know, that plot turn can be convincing. I mean, that just put the kibosh on any possibility of that. Francois Truffaut interviewed Warren, I think, talked to Warren Beatty about making the film. So did Godard. I can't remember which one of them said it, but after meeting Beatty, they said, no, we're not going to touch this film as long as he's in it. He just had a massive ego. At any rate,
it worked out.
I think we're back to Aaron.
We did. We are. But the film ended up being a hit. Proved everyone wrong. The movie ended up being a hit and proved a lot of people wrong. As far as, or at least it was popular with the kids. That's more the way to go.
Oh, it's huge. It was huge. Especially at first, it got terrible movie reviews.
Yeah. Except and Ebert was all about it. Ebert was like, this movie rules, you guys are ridiculous.
So did Pauline Kael. Pauline Kael's review really helped. So they re-released it. And that's when it became really, really big. So, mm-hmm. And they got all the Oscar nominations. And was, I think, number 2 at the box office. Graduate, I think it was number 1.
Graduate was like by far. It was a huge hit. My next film is, I'm going to move away from France for a bit. I'm going to go to Swing in London for Poor Cow, a film that I've been wanting to see since every time I watch Steven Soderbergh's The Limey, which uses clips from Poor Cow to reflect Terrence Stamp's early life, which I always thought was a clever bit of thing, even though I hadn't seen the actual movie that this is from. I'm not going to say that this movie is way different than what I expected it to be, because I'm like, ah, it's a 67 Ken Loach film. I'm sure it's probably not going to be a super cool heist flick with Terrence Stamp or something like that. But it is, in fact, a very much a Ken Loach, his debut film, for one thing. But it certainly fits with the other Ken Loach films that I've seen as far as being this, like, depiction of socioeconomic struggles and class structures and how some people try to fiend for themselves despite everything going on around them. Carol White is like the true star of this movie. Terrence Stamp's in this for like the first act, and he's very good. He's Terrence Stamp. He's fun to watch. But she plays this mother who has like an abusive husband who's like into crime, and then he goes to jail. Terrence Stamp comes in as he's like one of the husband's friends. And he's just a much kinder person, but then he goes to jail too because crime. What are you gonna do? And so she's stuck in this position where she has to like make money for herself, and she's like a barmaid or like a model. She's too much of like a swinger herself, so she doesn't want to go into like the life of a prostitute, which like the aunt that she lives with is like an aging prostitute. There's a lot of stuff here, but it's like, oh man, the 60s. The movie, of the movies I watched for this is probably the least impressive to me, but I still found it to be interesting as a watch, certainly because of, I was curious what like a Ken Loach film from many, many years ago compared to the films I've seen of his of late looked like, and I was like, oh, he hasn't changed much as far as what he's, but that reflects more of the populace that he's going after and not opposed to his filmmaking style. There's a Donovan score in this movie, which is nice. The look of London at the time, I mean, it looks like, compared to other like swinging London movies, like, I don't know, Blow Up, this movie is so much more gritty and real, in a way that is, you know, fairly depressing at times. As a drama, it's fine. It works well enough. I think the performances do so much of the work to make this movie like overall, you know, work as a recommend from me. But in terms of what it's after, it's like, yeah, this is just a lot of, nowadays it would be this like A24 misery porn drama. This, as it stands, is like, yeah, all right, it's not as, I don't know, transgressive as the other like new wave films that I've been talking about, but it works as an efficient character study that happens to have really good performances in it.
Not seen it. So when I always say, I'm going to see it see it along with Kess, and I never end up seeing it. So I've seen a number of his other films. It came at the end of the Kitchen Sink, working class dramas, which stopped once swinging London took over. The economy got better and London was the center of everything, stylistically and thematically, and people didn't want to watch the depressing kitchen sink movies anymore, and we now got the swinging 60s in London. So yeah, it was sort of like, you know, but he managed to keep making films, as you say, without changing much over the years. He's always been with the working man. He's always been with the poor. He's always been a socialist or a communist. Mm-hmm. And he never really has changed.
No, I must admit, that's partly why I'm not a big Ken Loach fan. I do love Kez. I adore Kez. But anything else I've tried to see from Ken Loach, I've just struggled with. I just find him a bit heavy-handed, and he's just kind of putting out the same spiel. I don't find him a very interesting director as such, but as I say, he often has good strong performances in his films, so they're quite often watchable, but I do struggle. But Kez though gets me every time. It's it helps that it's set kind of not a million miles away from where I grew up, up north. And Poor Cow is one I've not seen, actually, so it's one I keep being tempted by, but because of my hit and miss of kind of relationship with Ken Loach, I've avoided it.
Here's the thing about Ken Loach.
Moving furniture in the background.
No, there's some work going on in my house, and it's mic's picking up more than I thought it would. Okay. The thing about Ken Loach, though, hilarious guy. Tells jokes all the time. Fun at parties. No, made that up. Not true. Probably really boring.
I think that, yeah, I like Ken Loach. His films don't often rise above what they are. So actually, I think Mike Lee works much, much better for me.
Sure.
Yeah, same here. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. But I've always wanted to see that. I've always wanted to see Kasson for whatever reason. David, this time I got it right, right? I didn't skip you?
Yes, you got me right.
It's your
time.
Turn?
It is my turn.
Ah, victory. My memory's coming back.
Well, I mentioned earlier that I didn't pick five spaghetti westerns, so this will be my last spaghetti western. And this is Faccia a Faccia, otherwise known as Face to Face. So this is by Sergio Salima, and it's one of three films he did with Thomas Millian, the others being Run Man Run, and the most famous of the three, which is The Big Gun Down. And it's a fantastic trio of films, really, and this stands up to those. So it begins in a classroom, and you have a history professor giving a lecture to some kind of young men, and he is very poorly, he believes he's dying, and this teacher, he's played by Jean-Marie Volonté again, and because of his ill health, he has to retire early, and he moves to Texas because the heat, the sun is supposed to make him feel better. And whilst he's kind of lounging around in Texas, he ends up being taken hostage by a notorious bandit played by Thomas Millian. And weirdly, all these spaghetti westerns I seem to have been watching from this year have a similar thing going on, where you have this weird relationship. It's kind of an odd couple relationship. But what this film does, again, it's quite political. And what this film, it's all kind of about power and ambition. And what happens is this initially very weak, timid history teacher, he ends up kind of getting involved with this gang leader. He starts to enjoy the thrill of this life, and realizes that he can get lots of money and power by doing these horrible things to people. And so the film is about a kind of both the characters turning. Supposedly Salima got the idea after his experiences in World War II, or the idea of an unusual incident, a dramatic incident, totally changing the personalities of someone. So this looks at how Thomas Millian, who's at the start of the film just a selfish, mean bandit who's just killing to get money, him kind of mellowing, whilst this history teacher, who wouldn't say boo to a goose, becoming really, really evil by the end of this film. And it plays on that a lot. And this is another film that, like Bullet for a General, I was very impressed by. Definitely upper tier spaghetti western once more. It's got some very sharp editing. I think that you get that a lot in Sergio Salima's films. Some nice match cuts, some really nicely blocked out sequences with nice bit of camera movement and framing. You've got an Ennio Morricone score, which is always welcome. Mm. So yeah, this I loved it. I really, really enjoyed this a lot. So yeah, a nice quartet, but definitely these last two were the ones that stood out for me.
I was wondering why Salima sounded so familiar, and he's the father of Stefano Salima, who directed the Sicario sequel, among other things.
Oh, right. I didn't know that. But he did a lot of Italian genre movies. He's quite famous for doing some stuff like that.
What I sort of find interesting about spaghetti westerns is that it's a genre that is sort of like film noir, and that fans of them will watch all film noir. It could be terrible and be not. There could be one scene in it, and that's the main reason to see it, because you just like that genre, and you have it for spaghetti westerns, you have it for gyo films, you have it for samurai films in Japan. There are just sometimes these genres that someone gets fascinated by, and for whatever reason. And I like the fact that you mentioned that, World War II and everything. I mean, so many spaghetti Westerns are anti-capitalist and anti-fascist and pro-individual and pro, just anti that. And it makes sense with World War II and the rise of the mafia that you have these spaghetti Westerns that are doing nothing but attacking these kind of, you know, fascistic organizations.
Yeah.
But I can see why.
And with what was going on in Italy at the time, I guess it was kind of bubbling up, and there's all the violence and things they had in the 70s that had come soon after the spaghetti Western boom. And the cinema changed with that too, because you ended up moving away from the spaghetti Westerns and into the Polizia Teschi films, the kind of cop movies. They quite often do reflect what was going on in Italy at the time. So it's always interesting to see. They, even if they're dismissed as kind of genre movies, because Italy had a tendency to find a genre that's popular and just ride it to death. Like they made hundreds of these in the space of just a couple of years. But yeah, as I learned going through a bunch this last couple of months, there's plenty of gems in there, plenty of gems. But like you mentioned, I'm one of these people where there's certain genres that I still enjoy watching them regardless. For me, Westerns in general, I do love a good Western. I'll stick on any. And film noir, in fact, and martial arts movies, as most of you know if you've heard me on this podcast before.
Was Face to Face in a box set, or how'd you watch it?
No, this is one I just had on DVD. It was released by Eureka a long time ago, but I think it's out of print now, so I'm not actually sure how to get hold of it these days.
That won't stop me. I'll find it.
But Eureka Eureka put it out on DVD. It's not had a Blu-ray that I'm aware of, not in the UK at least. But it's well worth checking out. I enjoyed it a lot.
You really want to know what's going on underneath the surface of a country, or, for example, in America, what led to the 60s. You don't go to the big budget films. You go to the B films. You go to the film noir. You go to the sci-fi horror films. And you go to the revisionist Western or psychological Western ones, the B films. The B films will tell you how people are really feeling in a country. Yeah.
You didn't go to Dr. Doolittle to find out about America's obsession with top hats and animals?
Todd.
Well, speaking of B films and also genres that were run into the ground, at the drive-in, a lot of times you would see biker films. So we're going to go to the film that introduced Billy Jack to the world, The Born Losers, released by American International Pictures, of course. The credited director is T.C. Frank, though that's just an alias. It's Tom Laughlin, the star who played Billy Jack and would return to that character several more times. The film is about a biker gang called the Born Losers who are terrorizing the poor citizens of Monterey, California. And they end up crossing paths with Billy Jack. And of course, that doesn't go well for them. Billy Jack is, of course, he's a half Indian, Green Beret, Vietnam vet. And, he doesn't like to see people get roughed up, and he steps in to take care of things. And this actually gets him into trouble. He gets thrown in jail trying to do the right thing. And then when he gets out, he goes back after the bad bikers and all that kind of stuff. It's a film that has a lot of the kind of mayhem and such that you like to see in a biker film, but there's a bit more to it as well. I one of the things that stuck out for me with this is just the colorful characters, the biker gang for one, but I mean, Billy Jack is just such a cool character. I totally get why Tom Laughlin latched onto this character and kept wanting to play him as many times as he could. I mean, he made three more movies as Billy Jack, and there's a fourth one that I guess, I don't know how far into production he got, but it didn't get finished or whatever, but he loved the character, and that comes through in this. It's a cool character. The film in general is just a unique look into the biker gang culture. It's got good use of locations. When it comes to biker films, this is one of the go-to movies. And I mean, I had seen the follow-up film first, and I will say I think that the 71 sequel, which is just called Billy Jack, is a better movie. But The Born Losers, seeing where it started, still a very entertaining entry in the biker film genre.
But the really biker, Billy Jack, I saw it when it came out. That's one of the few films that I saw, you know, when it came out. And it's very entertaining. It's not very good, but boy, it was entertaining. It made a lot of money, and people my age, teenagers, really loved it.
The biker film genre seems like such a bygone era of film, like more so than Westerns, more so than, like, film noir is just like, there's an obvious, like, and even that's comes back with neo-noir every so often. Biker film seems like such a very specific time and place where I don't know if, like, youth of today, and I'm not that old, youth of today will watch, will, like, think of the idea of, there was a time when there was a genre just focused on people on motorcycles. That was a thing. Like, that seems like such a curiosity by comparison to other film genres that exist out there.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's very true. I mean, we had the television series,
Sons of Anarchy,
about the bikers, Sons of Anarchy. And we'll find out how well it does when, what's the movie that's coming out?
The Bike Riders, Jeff Nichols.
We'll see how well that does at the box office.
But even then, that's like more, you know, art house character drama that happens to be about a boat, as opposed to the whole thing is, these are guys and they're on bikes. There's a plot. Like, that's like the extent of the genre. Well,
that's postmodernism for you. Take the really, the B films, the exploitation films, the grindhouse films, and 20 years later, you make A films, you make art house films out of it.
And yeah, that's what I was saying about, like, at the top, as far as watching 67 movies, there's a lot of just, the plot is so inessential, and it's largely groups of people gathering to either argue, talk, or banter with each other, and then they move to another scene and do the same thing. Like, there's so much aimlessness, and it's not a flaw, that's just how a lot of these films function, and it's fine. Where nowadays, people complain so much about story, and it's like, shut up. there's so many things that go into a film that aren't just the story, and so many complaints out there. It's frustrating.
Okay, so that was Todd?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're up.
Yeah. I should have said, I remember going to drive-ins when I was young, mainly because even though you're supposed to be 18, they never checked your IDs. So you'd see these R-rated films and things, and you go for the sex and everything, even though you're underage. And it was just a thing you did every weekend. That's where I saw one of the worst films ever made, Meyer Breckenridge. So that actually brings back memories, going to the drive-in. I actually did that. So I guess it's my turn, right? And I'm going spaghetti western. This is The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, directed by Sergio Leone, with Clint Eastwood as the good, Lee Van Cleef as the bad, and Eli Wallach as the ugly. I wonder how Eli Wallach felt about that. And it's basically inspired by The Partner's Tale and Treasure of Sierra Madre. You have all these people hunting for a treasure of gold. It was, I guess, you know, it was such a huge hit in the U.S. that made Clint Eastwood a star. It also changed something with ratings, and that it used to be, at least in the U.S., but I think everywhere, you couldn't see someone shoot a gun and the person get hit in the same scene. You had to cut away after the shot, and then cut away, and then you saw the guy get hit. And this is like the first movie where, no, the guy shoots and you see him get hit. And Clint Eastwood said that kind of changed everything, and now things were filmed. I love those Sergio Leone films. And for those who like this one, I highly recommend South Korea's Ji-Woon Kim's remake called The Good, the Bad, and the Weird.
That rules. Oh, yeah. I love that movie.
Yes. It's wild. I understand they call it The Good, the Bad, and the Weird because they couldn't get the copyright, or they couldn't get permission to call that. But that's my fourth choice. I'm sure a lot of you have seen this.
Yeah, you can't go wrong with this one. I was happy to see it at the Chinese theater, the Grauman's Chinese, whatever it is now, but the man's Chinese theater. It's everything. It's just cinema. Like, just watching that movie, people can argue about length these days, even though everyone seems to be going to 3-hour movies and being completely fine with that. that movie is, you know, packed, and it's Dave, you know this, it's a spaghetti western, an epic one, where it's not like momentum is a huge, like, deal with them. They're like, no, just be long, whatever. But there's so much, like, packed into what's happening on frame every scene, despite being fairly minimal, because Leone, he's not about, like, let me have a ton of extras and all this stuff. But it's just fun to be in these worlds with him. And I had seen Good Bad, like, early on in my life before I had seen the other two. So when I got a box at the, I watched Fistful of Dollars, I was like, that's good. And I watched for a few dollars more, and I'm like, this movie rules. I love this. Give me more of this Lee Van Cleef all day. And I'm like, watching the third one now again, having these two in context, I'm like, well, this is just Eli Wong's. It's like, let me come in here and just do a whole thing. And it's just great. It's so much fun to watch this movie. And it's so, like, there's an odd amount of pathos that comes into play, like, in the second half, between, like, the Civil War stuff that's taking place, and then just because you form such a bond with Eastwood and Wallach's characters, it's fun. It's a real, despite the fact that they still, like, hate each other, it's just fun to watch. It's a fantastic movie.
Oh, it's amazing. Yeah, I'm a big, big Leone fan. But yeah, I had this down as 1966, but I had just looked it up, and I think in Italy it was released in, like, late December 1966, and everywhere else it was 67. So it didn't come up on my when I was scrolling through my collection. But yeah, it's stunning. I mean, Once Upon a Time in the West is my favorite film of all time, but the rest of the Dollars trilogy are just as strong. Yeah, I love it.
Okay, Aaron.
So I'm at an impasse here because you chose Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, which is it's 66, 67. I have Blow Up as a potential one to talk about, which says 66, but it was like it won the Palme d'Or at 67. It's on Ebert's 1967 top 10 list. Like, is that can I do that, or can I go with something else?
No, you can't.
Yeah, sure.
Blow Up. All right. Then I'll just cheat and say my backup was Samurai Rebellion. Toshirô Mifune kills like 40 people in 10 seconds. Oh, it's fucking cool. So Blow Up. Michelangelo Antonioni, one of the best director names of all time. This movie I really, really love. I'm so happy that I was able to see this before I've seen the other films that it influenced, because I have no idea how I'd feel otherwise. I feel like I'd still recognize this movie as a masterpiece, but like having seen this before I saw Blow Out and The Conversation, one of my absolute favorite movies, seeing this one, which other films that like kind of define, like, serve as like proto entries of genre, you can see not necessarily weaknesses, but you can see why other films expanding off of those things can be more highly regarded. This one, while it serves as this kind of like foundational piece, so here's an early depiction of swinging London on film and paranoia and varying other like tropes and stuff you'd see in films like the ones I mentioned, among others, this is still just a great version of that kind of story, where you have this guy played by David Hemmings, who's a photographer, and he's a really hip photographer. He gets all these models to come to his house. He takes pictures of them. And then just him being in nature, he stumbles upon like a couple, takes a picture of Vanessa Redgrave, young Vanessa Redgrave is among them. He takes some pictures, and she's freaked out about it. He doesn't know why. Things occur, but again, it's one of these movies where there's just a lot of stuff happening, but not a lot of plot. But eventually, some kind of a plot sort of occurs, where he sees in his picture, as he blows it up, that there's perhaps something seedy that's happened that's taken place. And he's trying to get to the bottom of that, and then he gets... just other things happen to kind of either verify his thoughts or mix them up even more. And then by the end, it goes into this like surreal direction that I absolutely love. This movie is wonderfully filmed. Again, it's another, like, outside of Italy and France, like, seeing color in movies is, there are choices being made, but like with Antonioni, it's like he knows what he's doing. Like, it looks fantastic. David Hemmings drives around in this, was like a Rolls Royce, and it looks wonderful. It's great. There's all these cool photography scenes of him, like, just being what you would now think is like a cliche of a photographer, but at that time it's like, this is just what it is, apparently, because it's like the first time we're seeing it. That stuff is really just fun and interesting. There's like scenes of, I love scenes in like 60s and 70s of people that just walk into bars or nightclubs, and you get extended montages of just the band playing. And this is one of those movies, like the Yardbirds is in this, like early on in their career. And you just get to like observe people just hanging out in the club, enjoying the music, instead of being like, and now let's talk about the plot while the band plays in the background. It's just like, no, let's just hang out here. This is fun. The mod subculture is just really on display throughout here. It's fun to see. It's a very stylish film. There's a lot of experimental ideas going on. There's a level of suspense that you might not see coming that kind of puts it in the realm of, I don't know, like a Hitchcock, I guess, but like not, because it's just like, it's too plotless to have that kind of a thing, but it's still, there's an inherent quality of like, oh, what's going to happen here? That going. So no, I'm a big fan of Blow Up. I'm happy to have seen it multiple times at this point. And yeah, it's a great movie.
I have a weird relationship with Blow Up. I saw it in college. I didn't like it. And then I saw it like two other times, still didn't like it. By the fourth time I saw it, I had what a friend of mine called making peace with things that don't work in a movie. And there are two things that just don't work for me in this movie that I don't buy. And the first one is when Vanessa Redgrave comes to get the pictures, you know, the central character, what's her name, the photographer, acts like there's something odd about this and wonder what's going on. I'm going, there's nothing going on. You took a picture of her with someone who wasn't her husband. She's acting very, very logical. There is nothing illogical or strange about what is going on here. The second thing is when he sees something in the photo, and I'm going, nobody, you're not Superman. Nobody has that good an eyesight. There is absolutely no way you saw anything remotely suspicious.
You're not a photographer, Howard. You don't know. You don't have the eye like he does.
The photograph is just too small. He wouldn't be able to see something unless it was really blown up. So I've never bought that. But if you can put those two things aside, which I now have, it's an incredibly beautiful movie. It's very existential, so it's really up my alley. Because by the end, you know, it's like La Ventura. There's no resolution. Mm-hmm. But that's what life is like. There's no resolution to these things in life. We don't know why they happen. We don't know the ultimate cause. We don't know the ultimate meaning. So, you know, we start hearing the tennis ball instead of just seeing a pretend tennis game. We actually start hearing the tennis ball because that's what life is like.
I love that ending. That's one of my favorite endings in movies. It's just the, when the sound starts coming, it's like, that's cool. That's a cool, like, and when I'm seeing that, I'm seeing this early college years, I'm like, well, that's fun. Like, that's a cool way to go. I haven't seen something like that before. I thought you were going to say that you hate mimes and that's the reason you don't like this movie.
No, they were fine. those kind of mimes bore me, but you know, the Marcel, I'm over Marcel, but,
yeah, but this one has a truckload of mimes, so I mean, the more the mimier, as I say.
Anybody else seen the film?
I haven't. It's a list of shame for me. It's one I've keep wanting to. I've seen the conversation. I've seen Blowout and stuff. I love both of them. So I'm keen to see it, and I just haven't got around to it. So yeah,
it's a very, I think, important film. Because of its introduction of it and La Ventura's introduction of existentialism into the American culture, into the American movie culture. Because after this, bad guys get away with things. Things happen that don't fully get explained. And it gets really, you know, we adapt a lot of that existentialism. Boy, I'm getting really, really brainy about these films today.
I'm happy that I've purposely chosen films that are set in London that Dave hasn't seen, just to shame him.
Yeah. I think, but to be honest, I think weirdly I always had something against British films when I was first getting into cinema. I think British cinema annoyed me because so much of it was kitchen sink dramas and period dramas. And I hated them both. I was like, oh, I don't want to see misery porn. I don't want to see a load of people dressed up in fancy costumes in expensive houses, sipping tea or whatever. It's screw that. So I kind of rebelled against that and wanted to watch films from elsewhere. But these days, I'm kind of going back. I'm starting to appreciate more of. I've been delving into some of the kind of British New Wave movies and things like that. And but there's a lot of there are a lot of gaps to plug.
Yeah, the life and death of Colonel Blimp, more like the life and death of me not watching this movie.
Powell and Pressburger, though, that is the I do like them. Although I must admit, I haven't got around to Blimp yet because it's so long. but yeah, matter of life and death.
If I chose not to watch this, I'll do something else.
To be fair, I'm half American. I blame my mum.
Well, we've been doing this episode longer than the runtime of Le Samurai because it's over.
And it will be regarded as just as much of a classic as Le Samurai. Yes. I'm sure.
Yes. Oh, this episode's going to be an all-timer, guaranteed. J-Who, that's what they'll say after they listen to this episode. No. Oh,
we've been saying that we were saying that while he was still host. No. I kid.
I was gonna be curious what Richard would have picked too.
Oh, well, I can tell. I it's funny, as I was looking through, I was like, oh, Richard will pick that. Richard will pick that. You know, like, there's a Bond film that year, even though it's You Only Live Twice. I'm like, Richard would have it on his list because
that's a good Bond movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's got a great.
Even Dave likes it. He hates England at this time.
Oh no, I love Bond.
Cool Hand Luke would be on Richard's list. I can guarantee that. I think Point Blank would be on Richard's list, which I can't argue with that one either.
Yeah, if I wanted to do, I'm not saying generic, if I wanted to do like a list of the popular things, like easily, these would be on my list. Like, these are great movies. I love these.
Yeah.
Like, literally, the second we got 67, like, it's going to take so much for me not to be talking about Cool Hand Luke or In the Heat of the Night. I'm just like, let me see what else I can do here.
In the Heat of the Night, the long-running television series, you mean?
Yeah. I watched all 200 episodes in preparation.
Yeah.
In the Heat of the Night, which has one of my favorite scenes in film history, when Sidney Poitier slaps the guy in the greenhouse, I'm like, yeah, Sidney, do it.
Have you seen either of the sequels?
I've seen both of the sequels.
I'm forgetting. I haven't seen Mr. Tibbs. I've seen the other one.
It's like The Conformer or something like that.
I'm forgetting the name right now. It starts with a C. I know that.
Well, The Conformist is literally a movie, so that's not it.
I only saw In the Night for the first time, I think last year, and I was really late to it, but it is a fantastic film.
I love that the organization. There it is.
Oh, that's it. Doesn't start with the C at all. No, yeah, the organization. Okay.
I didn't realize until way later that it was a series of movies, and it's like, oh wow, like Sidney Poitier was not just a movie star, but he had a fucking franchise to himself.
Yeah.
And that's so for a black actor in the 60s, 70s, has like outside of Richard Roundtree, it's like he had a franchise to go for. That's great.
And it's the last kind of film you'd expect a franchise from. It doesn't feel complete. It's just,
the story's so one off, and then it's like, no, we can keep Tibbs going.
I think we're at David.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. So
doing much better now.
Okay, so for my final pick, as I said, I veered away. I had planned, I had five Spaghetti Westerns picked out. There was another Django one in there that I was going to watch. And then I was sent something to review, and I loved it. And I was like, no, I've got to talk about this because it's one of these films where nobody's heard of it. And I loved it so much, I kind of want to spread the word. So I had to throw this in there. And that's a film called Happy End, or... No, I'm not going to try and pronounce it the Czechoslovakian title. But yeah, this is a Czechoslovakian film by Oldřich Lipský. And in Czechoslovakia around 67, you've got a lot of the Czech New Wave films out coming out, some really big, fantastic Czech films. But this isn't really classed as the Czech New Wave because Lipsky had been making films since the 50s. So he's technically kind of the old guard. But this is every bit as kind of, well, it's more out there than a lot of the Czech New Wave films. So Happy End, the way Happy End works is it opens with, whilst the credits are running, you start to see it kind of jigsaw style. You see this image coming together and you realize it's a man's head that's been taken off his body. And then it comes back and it goes from there. You go backwards. The entire film plays backwards from this man's death to his birth, completely in reverse. And you realize that this man, he's a butcher. He's played by Vladimir Mensik, and he murders his wife and her lover because he caught them having an affair. So he murders them, and that's why he's executed. And the film plays all of that situation backwards. But in playing it backwards, it turns this kind of this story of murder into something bizarrely kind of wholesome. And it just mines every little bit of humor it possibly can out of this bizarre kind of reversal of the situation. And it is an absolute joy. A lot of the jokes come from there's a voiceover running throughout, kind of explaining what's going on, but it's explaining things as though the reverse is the norm. So he talks about at the beginning when he's taken from his execution, which he calls his birth, he's taken to prison, and to him prison is school. And he's like telling about how he learned all these things, and he's stitching together potato sacks is his job in prison. He's like, he learned how to tear open all these potato sacks, and he's usually, you kind of give whatever items you've got on you give away when you go to prison, but he's like coming out of prison and they give him loads of stuff. But then one of the things that they give him, he's given a suitcase and he says he's given a wife to assemble. So he takes his dismembered wife in a suitcase and reassembles her, and he's like, wow, they've given me a wife after I left school. And it kind of goes on from there, and it's utterly bizarre. And another aspect of the humor comes from things playing out in reverse. And it's all done very, very cleverly. It's not the first film to kind of play with reverse chronology like this, but it wasn't the last. But it just does it so well. There are some obvious bits where just the quirky things, like seeing someone eat backwards, which is kind of gross, but kind of funny at the same time. And it just had me laughing out loud more than I've had in a film for a long, long time. It got criticized when it first came out, thinking that it was a bit of a one-trick pony, and especially because at the time there was all the Czech New Wave films coming out that were garnering all the attention, and this was seen more of a bit of a throwaway kind of one-joke film. And In a sense, I agree. It is a one trick pony in terms of it is just purely mining everything it can from this premise, but it does it so well, and it's furiously paced. Which could be too much. It could prove to be too much because it's so fast paced and because it's kind of doing one thing in a variety of ways. But it's very short. It's 73 minutes. You don't have time to get bored. It just fires and fires and fires, and it's just utter sheer joy that I would highly recommend anyone check it out, really. Brilliantly made, hilariously funny and very clever, and doing the kind of backwards thing long time before Memento and Christopher Nolan's kind of movies. It's
I have heard of this movie. I've seen a few Czech New Wave films. I'm always like, I want to see more of these because this just seems like so interesting to me. You said you got this to review. Like, is it on a new Blu-ray or is it on like a set or something? Or?
Yeah, it's just been released in the UK by Second Run on Blu-ray. Yes, it's definitely worth picking up.
I have an all region player because I'm all about like just getting stuff that I can that's like cool and obscure. Yeah,
go for it. I think it's out now. Yeah, it came out at the end of March, so yeah, it's definitely out now.
And now when you say reverse chronology, is it like literally like people walking backwards or like Memento as far as you see segments?
I didn't explain it clearly enough, but yeah, it is, the movements are properly all the movements are reversed, everything is reversed, but the difference is, and this is another thing, another part of the comedy that I didn't mention, is the dialogue isn't, the dialogue is the words make sense, but what it does is it breaks it into sentences and plays the lines backwards. And there's loads of humor kind of brought from this. So the conversations run in reverse. So, for instance, I'd written one out somewhere. I'm just looking at my review now.
Reminded like the David Lynch Red Room, but it's funny this time. That's what
you're like. Yeah, yeah. I've written it out somewhere. Sorry, bear with me a second. Oh, yeah. So when he's at trial, this butcher, he's asked, who put the corpse in your suitcase? And he just replies, the judge, because he's obviously in reality, he's answering something that was said before. But in this reverse chronology, it plays with that all the time. The script must have been painstakingly put together because almost every line is some kind of gag because of the way it plays out and the way it goes in reverse. So it's just, as I say, meticulously put together, but very, very, very funny.
It sounds like a film I really would like to see. It reminds me of a book, Time's Arrow, by Martin Amis, in which at first you're reading this book and you think there's something off. And you finally figure out, oh, this is going in reverse chronological order, but, you know, not like scenes. I mean, it is going backwards in time. And it's really interesting. And then it gets to the Holocaust. And you realize that the central character was a doctor at a concentration camp. But now, instead of killing Jews, they're putting ashes in ovens and giving birth to Jews. And when you die by entering your mother's womb. And everything's, and it's just shattering when that sort of thing starts happening. So it's a great idea. There have been other things that have been in reverse order, but not quite like that. Like Merrily We Roll Along from the 1920s is told in reverse order, but it's, and Betrayal is told in reverse order, but each scene goes forward and is done chronologically forward. It sounds great. I can't wait to see. Hopefully it'll come up on Criterion sometime.
Yeah, hopefully it's been picked up because it's been like kind of restored, and that's why this Blu-ray's come out. So I'm sure it'll be doing the rounds stateside. Yeah, it's a region free Blu-ray as well. The one that's come out in the UK.
Ooh. So you're like, I'll rush into getting it, then like Criterion or Arrow or like a month later, guess what we got, guys? And I'm like, fine.
Okay, Todd, this is it. This is it. This is the biggie.
Well, of course, we covered a lot of genres that were frequent in the drive-ins, but we haven't done a horror film yet. So we're going to end with Jack Hill's disturbing but also playful horror film, Spider Baby, which is a creepy tale of a family of young adults who suffer from a condition where they basically all have the minds of children, and that is played out in deadly ways. They are all living in their mansion under the care of their loyal chauffeur, played by Lon Chaney Jr. The children, the quote unquote children in this, are played by Sid Haig, Jill Banner, and Beverly Washburn, and they all turn in wonderfully creepy performances, especially Jill Banner, who delivers one of those kind of disturbing but sexy type performances. Sid Haig, also a real standout here. But I can't skip over Lon Chaney Jr., who, you know, he was one of those actors that, you know, he was in a lot of these horror movies and had a way of bringing characters that were monsters but were sympathetic, that you couldn't help but feel for this guy. And he brings great heart to this film. You really feel for him, even though he is involved in some pretty awful things. It's a film that has great visual style, beautiful black and white photography. And it's such that it's, you know, it's one of those films that makes really ugly things beautiful the way that it photographs it. It gets pretty dark and unsettling, but it's also got an undeniable sense of humor to it. Just a film that it really surprised me when I watched it, because this is one of those films that you can find everywhere. You know, you can find it in bad copies on YouTube and things like that. And, you know, people, I've seen videos where people like ranked this as one of the worst movies ever made. And after I watched that video, I said, the people that put this together obviously did not watch this film, because this is a wonderful, you know, just kind of weird, creepy film that also has a weird humorous streak to it. Also quite influential. I mean, you watch this and you can see echoes of it in, you know, things like Texas Chainsaw Massacre or things like that Rob Zombie did, you know, the creepy family doing weird type of stuff. I just really was charmed by this strange little horror film.
Who says Mantan Moreland in it? Have a seat.
Yes, he is.
Did he do one of his routines, or was he just acting?
No, he's just acting in it. He plays, if I remember correctly, a messenger who unfortunately doesn't make it very long in the film.
Oh. As messengers often don't.
Yeah.
But he's very funny, and especially in he's much better than Step and Fetch It was for the Charlie Chan films. So I guess that leaves me, doesn't it?
It does.
And I have to go to my thing here. This should be no surprise since I pineapple kiosked it early, whatever the verb form of pineapple kiosk is. And it is Playtime, which is one of the great French films. It's from French filmmaker Jacques Tati. It's one of the great farces of all times. It stars Tati as Monsieur Hulot, Tati plays in a large number of his films. There's not a lot of plot. Hulot arrives in Paris, and he's trying to find a friend or find an address, but he curiously wanders around this new high-tech Paris along with a group of American tourists. And there's also this nightclub restaurant that prepares it's getting ready for opening night, but it's still under construction. And it all converges in this just riotous ending. As I said, it's a bit difficult to explain because there really isn't much of a plot. It's just there's all these visuals and these little set pieces, and the way that Hulot looks at Paris. Paris just doesn't look like, I mean, it just has a very, everything is very funny. The way he looks at it, the sounds, everything is just very funny. So I think it's one of the great farces. I think it's one of the great French films. Certainly, Tati is probably his greatest film. I saw a restored version of it. I can't remember how long ago. And it was just incredibly gorgeous to look at.
Yeah, as I was saying early on, I've been wanting to see this film for such a long time. And I try to see films like this the best way I can, whether it's like Lawrence of Arabia or something, where it's like, I want to watch this in the 70 millimeter format that he purposely made this film in, which possibly led to its demise at the box office. But I, you know, just seeing it on the fancy Blu-ray it has from Criterion on my large TV, it did the job because this film is wonderfully enormous. Like the idea of building this just massive set to contain so much, like vignettes and play with art style and varying forms of comedy. I really I knew this would be completely my speed, and I was very happy that it delivered on that. I love that it's like, it feels like a silent film that's not, as far as much like, you know, with Tati's kind of humor, like the dialogue's not important at all. And it's, there's so much, you know, there's music and there's physical comedy playing out, so it's not like you need words to really tell the story that's going on here. So it has this sort of, I don't even know what the term would be, like post silent film thing going for it, where it just has like a different kind of approach.
In silent film time, these were called sound films, but because there was a film that had sound to it. But you're right. I mean, the dialogue is pretty much unintelligible, and there's not much of it. And it's not supposed to be intelligible. I mean, it's beside the point.
Yeah. You know? And the use of color is really interesting, too, where it's shot in a way where it's drab, not drab, but it's like it's a lot of non-primaries on purpose. So you can have highlights and scenes where there are primary colors and things being used like that. So it has a very deliberate look to it that I appreciated as well.
For example, one of the earliest scenes, it's a very small scene. Hilo arrives somewhere. I can't remember if it's at the airport or if it's at a business. And two nuns just walk down. And you kind of hear their headgear a little flapping and they're bouncing. And it's just funny. It's not plot. It's not take the story anywhere. It's just so funny. So, and the whole movie is sort of like that. He just finds humor in all sorts of things.
For sure.
I think that's it. So at this time, that is it, right? We've got everybody, everything's done.
Yeah.
So at this time, we shall take a short break and listen to a promo for a sister podcast.
Listen up, ladies and gentlemen. Our podcast, The One-Armed Bennett, will cover all 130 minutes of the classic 1993 action thriller, The Fugitive, 3 minutes per week.
Average length of each episode, including guests, is approximately 30 minutes, giving us a total expected running time of 65 hours.
So what we want out of each and every one of you is to listen along with us for the next year to our hard target search through every plot detail,
character breakdown,
guest segment,
movie trope, Star Trek reference, and corny joke in each minute.
Episodes go up starting on January 1st, so please stay subscribed and recommend this podcast to all your movie-loving friends.
Your podcast name is The One-Armed Minute. Now go listen.
Well, welcome back, and we are going to start closing out. The exit question today was, which movie from 1967 would you like to... would you think should or could be or would like to see remade, and bonus points for director and actors. So whoever wants to jump in.
Well, obviously Michael Bay's Young Girls of Rochefort would be fantastic. with Shia LaBeouf in his Bang on the Head era. I have a pick that is just as good. As people may know, I'm a very big Godzilla fan. Son of Godzilla came out in 1967. And because it's one of the lesser Godzilla films, even in the Showa era, I would say naturally that means that's the one you remake. And Godzilla's so prolific right now, between his recent Oscar win, his new blockbuster, and his TV series, Real Renaissance Lizard, as they call him. I think Son of Godzilla will be the next logical step. And who better to do that than a director that handles daddy issues all the time? That's right, Steven Spielberg, who's always wanted to make a Godzilla movie. Put him on board, and who do you get to play these characters? Well, he's been working with Mark Rylance a lot. He literally played the BFG, so that just makes sense. Be Godzilla, Mark Rylance. There you go. He's now. Mark Rylance, he's a great actor. And, I mean, just keep it, like, British, I guess. So, like, get Barry Keoghan in there. He could be Son of Godzilla. It's two of them.
Yeah.
The set picks alone of them in like blue stockings with dots all over them would be phenomenal. That'd be the best. make it a story about like Godzilla's like a bad dad. He's like, dad, you went and trashed the city again, and his son's just angry at him. He's like, but you got to learn how to be angry too, son. And he teaches him how to stomp over cities and fight, you know, a lobster or like a giant spider or caramungus or whatever. It'd be great. I feel like this, the MonsterVerse, I'm writing letters. We're seeing what Legendary is going to do with this. Well, get the beard on board. I think this will work.
You know, you had a not, I guess, exactly a Son of Kong, but a baby Kong in Godzilla Times Kong.
It's the natural next step.
Exactly.
I don't want to do it.
I was kind of disappointed that there wasn't a baby Godzilla in that new film.
They're saving it for naturally this brilliant idea that I'm proposing for them. Like, it's gonna happen.
There's gonna be a labor scene in the Colosseum. It'll be great.
Yeah. Yes. That's how it'll start, with the labor scene. Yeah. Really get you on Godzilla's side. Like, oh, his mom died. Like,
yeah.
That's great. Anybody else?
Well, I struggled with this, and I just decided to go with the first thing that kind of made me chuckle when it went through my mind. Hear me out here, folks. I know it'd be controversial to replace the king, Elvis Presley, but hear me out. Ryan Gosling in Clambake.
Boom. Great.
He could totally be
better already, just the casting alone makes it a better movie.
I think Elvis movies are goofy fun. Gosling could totally be the heir of an oil empire who goes to Florida to become a water ski instructor. I mean, you know, come on. Clambake, keep the same theme song. It's a great theme song, you know.
Just think of a giant poster that says Gosling in Clambake. Oh, yes. My God. The marquees would just literally get set on fire.
And he can sing and dance because he grew up.
Absolutely.
This is a completely serious pitch I'm hearing from Todd. There's no sarcasm in this whatsoever.
No, absolutely not. No, I am on board.
I think these are both great ideas.
Thank you, Howard.
Did you have one, David?
I did. I've not put as much thought into mine, but because I was out today and just saw the message before the podcast. I'm going to go with that. I've spent a whole podcast without talking about any like martial arts movies. So so I'm going to throw in, there's a classic wuxia from 1967 is The One-Armed Swordsman. And straight after that was released, Jimmy Wang Yu himself, who was the star of that film, made two sequels. He made dozens of rip-off semi-sequels. He made loads of one-armed swordsman-themed type films within the space of a few years. But then they dried up. Sui Hark made The Blade, which is kind of a remake. But there's not been one for a while. So I figure, let's bring the one-armed swordsman idea back. And if we're thinking of modern kind of action director-star duos, it's got to be Chad Stahelski, or however you pronounce it, and Keanu Reeves. Doing the new one-armed swordsman. I think you can't go wrong with that.
Not into it.
Does he talk much? If he doesn't talk much, then Keanu Reeves would be perfect.
Well, you can change it up. You can keep his mouth shut in this one.
He's not exactly super verbose in the past several action movies he's done. But,
right. No, that sounds great. Yeah, I could see that, actually. I could see Keanu Reeves as a... Just kill his dog and take his arm away and he'll come after you.
Come get revenge. But yes, well, learn the skills of one-armed weaponry. Yeah.
And his dog is only has only three legs. So, you know.
Yeah, well, that maybe his own arm hasn't lost its dog's leg. Yeah, I like it.
My choice is going to be Jean-Luc Godard's Weekend. Mm-hmm. We're going to put it in Los Angeles. It's going to star Tom Hardy and Charlize Theron, and it's going to be directed it's going to be directed by David Lynch.
Oh boy! Okay,
okay.
On board.
We could go with George Miller, but I think I'd rather go, especially in the second half. Maybe George Miller could do the first half, and David Lynch could do the second half.
Nice. Yeah. Laura Dern's going to have a field day as a cameo in this one.
Yes. Okay. Well, now we are closing out, so we need to find out what is happening in your guys' life and what you are promoting. So, Aaron.
Okay. I host a podcast called Out Now with Aaron and Abe. We talk about the weekly movie releases, and we do a lot of fun bonus stuff as well. That includes commentary tracks every month, and we have our upcoming summer movie Gamble, where we'll be predicting the top 10 highest grossing films of the summer, which is a lot of fun and very competitive. I am the editor-in-chief over at We Live Entertainment, where I write my movie reviews. I also write reviews for Why So Blue for Blu-ray and Criterion reviews, and I'm on all the socials at Aaron's PS4.
Fantastic. David?
Well, the big thing, I don't think I've plugged this on a Lamcast yet, because I have actually resurrected the Blueprint Review podcast. It disappeared for, I don't know, 5-6 years, and I have just decided to resurrect it this year, and I'm 2 episodes in so far, so I'm on a very small roll, and I'm hoping to do it monthly, and it's a very loose conversation, just about what we've been watching from our kind of Blu-ray collections, and I bring on another couple of writers, and we just chat movies, very loose, very straightforward, but hopefully a good listen. So yeah, check it out.
Who was on the most recent episode?
Oh, it was Jay. Jay.
Oh, that was it. Was, okay.
Jay threw in Leon Vegas. So yeah, I'm mixing it up a little bit each week. There's different. It depends who's around. Because I've got quite a large pool of writers on Blueprint Review. But yeah, Jay showed up this month, and hopefully he'll be on future episodes if I didn't put him off.
We haven't lost Todd again, have we?
No, I'm here.
Todd. Oh, it's your turn. What's going on? Tell us everything.
Podcast is the Forgotten Film Cast, and we're releasing episodes all the time. Some of the most recent ones, we did an episode on Clint Eastwood's The Gauntlet. Last week, I was joined by Jason Soto to discuss a film from 1999 called The 13th Floor. I think we're not going to have an episode this week because just some scheduling things didn't work out, but hopefully we'll be recording soon about a yet another kind of satanic panic film from the 70s, To the Devil, a Daughter. And Howard's going to be on soon. We're going to be talking about The Rosary Murders. So that's coming up soon.
Yeah, we have that of the 19th, I think you said.
Yeah, later this week we're recording.
Yeah, a forgotten film from, I think it's Canadian, but it has Donald Sutherland and Charles Durning in it. So hopefully it's still as entertaining like I remember when I first saw it, but you never know. But I'm looking forward to that. We did The Gauntlet on Pop Art. We combined it with The Hitman's Bodyguard. About someone trying to get a witness from place to place. Mine really hasn't changed yet. I meant to get the Valentine's Day episode on Friday, up on Friday, but it didn't happen, though it's all done. I just have to upload it. And it's with Richard Kirkham, who is not here today. And it's Ghost and Truly Madly Deeply, about two people who come back from the dead to interact with their loved ones, whether you want them to or not. Then we have The Vern, where we did May, December, and A Dream of Passion, two films about actors who go, who need help doing their parts, so they seek out someone similar or something similar to help them achieve that. And then Todd, I have the fantastic Mr. Fox and Straight Time to start working on, which is about two ex-cons trying to go straight. So with that, I want to thank all of you for coming on to the show, all you youngsters, and everybody out there, this was the Lamcast. Have a great week.
You've been listening to the Lamcast. If you have an idea for a show or would like to join us on the Lamcast, contact us at largeassmovieblogs.com. Find us on Facebook, just search for Lamcast, or on X, formerly Twitter, at Lamcast. And you can find us on YouTube as well. The Lam site can be found at largeassmovieblogs.com. We'd also love it if you would leave a review on iTunes.
It's over!